modality yesterday was saying it'd be good maybe in the new year to go out and actually see what's happening on the ground and things, because it really does make a difference.
Have you been before?
Sorry?
Have you been to China before?
Yeah, I went in 2012.
Oh, wow, proper. Okay.
Yeah, but I only did Beijing, Shanghai, Xi'an. And then the last time I went out on a work trip was 2019. We went to Shenzhen, just went across from Hong Kong to meet with a few companies. And
was there a marked difference between 2012 and 2019 in terms of the country?
I hadn't been to Shenzhen before, but... So I can't directly compare the two, but if I was comparing somewhere like Shanghai in 2012 to when I went to Shenzhen in 2019, the rate of development or the change development was quite huge. I thought what was really interesting is that the streets are kind of eerily quiet just because there's just EVs everywhere. So you don't hear cars
They just like swoosh around.
Yeah, I almost got hit by one because you just don't hear them coming.
That's a good point.
And I hear more and more that's the case in lower tier cities now. So that's been the case in kind of tier one cities for a while, but lower tier cities now with the penetration.
They've got all the charging ports, all that infrastructure's there.
Yeah, they've heavily invested in the grid. Yeah, it's something.
And I guess when you're creating your own cities from scratch, you can implement it.
Yeah,
just trying to put infrastructure in backwards is more difficult.
Exactly. And that's why they're saying that a lot of the developing countries will just be able to leapfrog developed because, we're kind of working through getting rid of old stuff and putting in the new.
They've done it a little bit with telecoms, haven't they?
Yes, exactly.
They've gone straight to 4G as opposed to building a 2G and a 3G network and and cables. They don't need cables.
We're still on 2G in the UK, aren't we? According to my phone. Never works.
How's married life going, Carly?
Good, yeah.
How long has it been now? Six months?
Honeymoon
period?
We've been together for about 11 years now. That honeymoon period ship has sailed. Nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed.
But it's nice to not be constantly thinking in the background about a wedding and things like that.
It does overtake your life for a...
It was a bit like every time we'd go out for like a nice dinner, it'd be in the back of my mind, kind of like, oh, we really just should be being a bit more conscious and be saving.
Well, it's funny that. So we're having some renovations done at home, and obviously it's quite, they've literally thrown the entire house upside down. So it's like, and it's not dissimilar. It overcomes your mind. And we were out and my wife, Tony, she was talking about it to some friends. I just sort of said, when she'd finished like going on about it, I said, having renovations done is a bit like being engaged. All you talk about is your renovations as opposed to your wedding. And she sort of turned to me and said, is that your code for telling me to stop talking about it? Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe, love. But there we go. Well, that's nice. That's lovely news anyway.
Yeah.
Welcome to the pod. Thank you. Are you ready to get... You need to be done by 10.
At least be done by 10.
Yeah. Well, you've got your suit and tie on, so clearly very important. It'll be very important to go to afterwards. good. Well, hello everyone and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 39. Delighted to be joined by Carly Morehouse alongside James Hughes, investment manager. Carly is one of our senior fund analysts here. She specializes in the Asia emerging markets area and has traveled extensively through Asia and is deeply experienced in all things China and emerging markets. So given all that's been going on, which we'll get into, we thought it'd be an opportune moment to have her on to discuss. So Carly, good morning and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
As a sort of preamble, really, for those that haven't sort of realised, it's been a pretty interesting year in markets, full stop, and we've talked about lots of stuff so far this year, haven't we, Heezy? AI, bond markets, politics, we're not going to talk about that today.
We've done a lot.
And obviously we had the Japanese carry trade got like smashed in August, so markets went through like a bit of volatility, and we talked about that with a little emergency pod on that, didn't we? And then middle of September, it all sort of kicked off in China. So the Chinese economy, it's fair to say, and the Chinese stock market has been through some difficult times in the last 10 years, in fact, and their economy is facing kind of falling house prices, high debt levels, slowing growth, and a few issues. So there was a sort of so-called bazooka of policy announcements made on the 24th of September on the monetary side of things. These included Things such as interest rate cuts on the 7-day reverse repo interest rate. The 1-year medium-term lending facility rate was lowered by 0.3%. Banks' reserve ratio requirements were reduced to try and encourage more lending. And interest rates on new mortgages were also cut. And the whole point really is to try and stimulate the economy, in particular the property market and the banking system, to try and get some credit creation going, to try and increase growth. As a result of that, we've put a chart up here of the Chinese equity market in blue, which is a 1-year chart. And then in orange, we've got the MSCI All Country Asia Pacific ex Japan index as a sort of broader Asia index alongside. And we can see that those policy announcements basically led to a 30% rise in the stock market in about 3 days. And it's fallen since then, it's fallen 15%, but it's sort of still sits 20 to 25% higher than it did in mid-September. So there is also the promise of some further policy announcements on the fiscal side of things. Those are scheduled for Saturday, the 12th of September, which will be after this pod probably goes out. So we'll see what that brings. But certainly investors have been enthusiastic about the Chinese equity market because of, you know, an extended period really of suboptimal performance. And indeed, just my sort of last chart before we sort of get cracking is on the valuation here. So we've got a 10-year chart of a forward price earnings ratio. You can see it was down at around 8.5-9 times earnings, which is a pretty big discount to not only its 10-year average, but also to kind of the rest of the world equities. For reference, US equities trade on about 20-21 times. And obviously that's gone up a little bit as the market's gone up, but still pretty cheap on 10.5 times, right? Mm-hmm. Carly, should we start with the market itself and what sort of equity market is it? How come it's been so bad over the last kind of 1 to 10 years? And are we at a turning point? Is it going to go up from here?
Oh, I wish I could. I wish I could tell you.
Just an easy question for five.
Yeah, exactly. I think the key thing here is that we do tend to see these big rallies in the Chinese market because of, you know, the fact that they can U-turn on policies and things very quickly. I think one of the last times we saw such a significant rally was obviously when they U-turned on zero COVID, which basically happened overnight. So I don't think it's the most surprising thing in the world that they've, again, U-turned very quickly and introduced all these stimulus measures, because I think, you know, the more and more weak data that was coming out, the closer we were probably getting to something like this.
And pretty much all the data that was coming out was horrible, right?
Everything was just disappointing month on month. And obviously they have this GDP growth target that they like to try and achieve. And, you know, as we get closer to the end of the year, it was looking less and less likely that this was going to happen. So see, the stock market has been very weak for the last few years. I think it peaked in about February of 2021. And since then, there have been a whole host of reasons as to why it's been bad. And, you know, a lot of that is to do with the Chinese government's own, you know, regulations that they've imposed on the economy. Well, really, I think the main thing has been the property market. It's been particularly weak, and that's because they were trying to, obviously deleverage that part of the market. It's been an area of rapid expansion over the last few decades, really. And so this kind of trying to deleverage the property market has led to a decline in property prices. And I think the fact that property is a significant part of households' wealth. I think it's about 50%. If the majority of your wealth is in property and you've just seen that continuously fall, obviously that's going to impact your willingness to spend, and that's exactly what we've seen happen. So the fact that they've done these stimulus measures, they have been doing them over the year, over the past few years, but it's been very piecemeal. you said about, you know, reducing interest rates and banks' reserve requirement ratios. So those things have been happening, but it's been quite piecemeal and, yeah, and very
sort
small.
Of all at once, right?
Exactly. So the difference here is that they've done it all at the same time.
Yeah.
And at a time when actually it was quite surprising because a Politburo meeting, which focuses on the economy, doesn't typically happen in September. So
right.
again, that
okay.
that signals some sort of urgency
yeah,
here
yeah, yeah. Sure.
that they need to do something about the economy.
Mm. And how much of that deleveraging has happened? Or is it just the start of it in terms of the property debt and private debt?
They've been trying to do this for a while, and you can really see that in the trajectory of house prices. So the first time it was mentioned was, I think, in 2017.
Okay.
I think that's when she first said about house prices or housing being for living and not speculating. So I think that was the first time it was mentioned, and then it was reiterated in 2020, around the same time that we started hearing much more about common prosperity, because you know, house prices continue to go up. The fact is that people can't, you know, afford to get into the property market.
Yeah.
And you had people, you know, wealthier people having, you know, multiple homes.
Mm.
So, you know, the idea around the regulation within the property market was partly to deleverage and also to avoid, you know, the property bubble bursting, but then also to facilitate this common prosperity that they've been, you know, talking about for some time. But yeah, it's been going on for a number of years.
We've got a longer term chart here of the Chinese equity market going back 10 years. And up until the recent kind of rip-roaring rally that we've had, you've basically not made any money at all. I mean, the chart starts at 100 and it, up until mid-September, it was 110. Now, as you mentioned, the Chinese stock market actually peaked in 2021, early 2021 at, you know, a pretty high level on this chart. So it's 230. So you double your money between 2015 and 2021, and then it halved since. So the recent rally is still, you know, you've not done particularly well in Chinese equities over the long term. Do you want to give us a flavour for how big is the Chinese equity market in the context of emerging markets as a whole, and then as a sort of proportion of the overall global equity market? Obviously, the US is about 65%. UK is, what, 4%, whatever it is. And what does the market look like in terms of stocks and sectors, and what sort of market is it?
Yeah, so in terms of the emerging market index, I think in 2020, so around the time of where it peaked, you know, China was getting to it was over 30% of the MSCI emerging markets, and today it's it was about 22, 23. I think it's gone up in the last a few weeks, but it had, you know, almost halved in terms of its weighting within that index. The market itself is very broad. It is, you know, one of the largest stock markets in the world. Obviously, you've got the onshore and offshore markets that we're thinking about as well, in terms of, you know, the A-share market onshore, and then H-share market in Hong Kong, which is a bit more foreign investor dominated.
And lots of stocks list on both, right? So that you have your listing on the Hong Kong market and in the Chinese market.
Is that is the aim now, especially because you know, some used to be just ADRs in the US, and with geopolitics and concerns about delisting from the US stock markets, they've started to list. Also, they've started dual listing in Hong Kong, and then also trying to list in the A-share market as well. So it is a very broad market. You know, it used to be much more around, you know, commodities and real estate and things like that. But over time, it has shifted to become much more consumer oriented as well. And you know, that is the trajectory of, or what the government want the overall economy to look like as well. They want it to be much more consumer focused, service led economy. Less about, you know, industrials and manufacturing and being the world's.
So you've got some pretty big tech stocks there as well. I think you've got Tencent, which owns WeChat, which is pretty much as big as what Tencent would be, a mix between, I guess, what, Google and Facebook.
Yeah, it's one of these that has multiple
things.
It's not just about talking to your friends. It's also kind of social media platform, and you can do a lot of different things on it. We don't really have the equivalent over here. No. It's kind of a bit of a super app, if you will, where you can do lots of different things.
And then there's kind of Alibaba, JD.com, Badoo.
Yeah, those are much more, JD and Alibaba are much more kind of e-commerce platforms, whereas Baidu's more search. So you have a lot by way of, these communication services companies as well. So it's a fairly broad market. So it does actually lend itself to a lot of opportunities.
Mm. No, sure.
And which type of stocks sort of led the rally, following the stimulus packages? It wasn't the whole market, but there were certain sectors that... obviously, the stimulus is more aligned to than others.
Yeah, it actually was the whole market at first.
Okay.
It was a kind of everything rally. Mm. And I think that was because you were seeing a lot of short covering from hedge funds.
Okay.
The allocation globally to Chinese equities is basically non-existent now.
Like the UK, really.
Yeah. So you had a lot of retail investors, fund managers, just trying to, it's not even about going overweight at this point. Mm, a lot of them just need to reduce the underweight to China. And so I think that's made quite obvious by the fact that everything rallied across the board. Mm. Obviously, there were certain sectors which were up more, but all were in positive territory. The ones that performed the best were obviously the ones that are more impacted by the stimulus. So, the consumer staples, consumer discretionary areas, real estate. So it was those types of companies that did particularly well, but everything did, as I was saying, because people were just trying to get exposure across the board. So a lot of ETF buying. Whereas prior to that, we did see a rally about May time as well.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And that was much more focused actually on, energy, financials, utilities. And I think that surprises a lot of people, but really it's because these are all kind of state-owned enterprises. So they're seen as the safe havens of the market. These are backed by the government. They're not going to go bankrupt anytime soon. And they also pay dividends of about 7, 8, 9%. So this is where actually the majority of the rally, that's what was driving it. It wasn't the consumer area. So we have seen a shift since the stimulus. Whether that's sustainable, as you said, we've already seen the market come off more recently.
Yeah, well, of course, the market was closed for a week last week, wasn't it, for a holiday?
Yeah,
right? And of course, the Hong Kong market was trading through that, and it was strong. And then the Chinese market opened on the Monday, initially up about 10%, and then dropped 6% to close. And we've had quite a lot of volatility again this week in the market, haven't we? So it's funny how we had this rip-roaring rally for 2 weeks, and all of a sudden we've got this... What are they doing? Are they going to come out with fiscal stimulus? Is it going to be big? What are they? So
yes, I think it's the questions around the fiscal stimulus side of things, because it's been signaled that that's what they're going to do, but there's not really any detail around that. And there was, I think, a press conference a couple of days ago where people expected more detail on the fiscal side, but it didn't come out. And then now we've got the Ministry of Finance, I think, talking about the fiscal measures on Saturday.
I think that time changes, I know it sounds really weird, but like the time zone differences and the times that markets are open doesn't really help with this thing. Because if we sit here in London at 10 a.m. decide we're going to buy some Chinese equities, we'll get an order on today. It will go through, probably won't go through tomorrow, will it? Because it probably missed today's cutoff. So it won't go through until, it's Thursday today. So we're going to go through to Monday now, and we don't know what's going to happen over the weekend. It's the same if you're in the US. You're going to miss a day. And if you're big global investors moving capital around and you're a fund manager who's been underweight China, you're like, oh, there's a rally, I better get some money in, because that's what human beings do, rightly or wrongly. Then, you can miss these days, and it all sort of kind of adds up to the volatility that we're seeing, really. I mean, it makes our job fun, I suppose, but fun is a word. Now, if we go back, like before the stimulus measures were announced, there was arguably some pretty good reasons why Chinese equities were trading on 8-9 times earnings, right? Well, number one, it's a communist state that private property rights are not necessarily sacrosanct as they are in the West, and I do think there is something to that.
Yeah.
But secondly, in terms of, we've got a chart here on Chinese house prices which, as you say, are quite a big part typically of household net wealth, and prices have been falling for a couple of years after a pretty kind of boom period before that. And then if we also look on the debt side of things, you know, lots of the kind of bears on China will say that they've got a huge pile of debt. So there's a chart courtesy of our friends at TS Lombard. Chinese private debt as a proportion of GDP is over 200%, which has gone up, pretty much doubled in the last 15 years compared to the US, where debt as a proportion of GDP is a lot lower. So they are a much more heavily indebted economy. And then, there's a chart here, which is the same sort of chart, really, which shows the increase in debt. So there's a much bigger rise in the level of debt as a proportion of GDP. So this has sort of come back to that point about, well, okay, the house prices have been really high and you've got loads of debt. So they're almost, is it fair to say that they're you could compare it to the US in 2008 when the property bubble blew up there? Again, you had lots of debt and then you had falling asset prices. And now we've got these kind of interest rate cuts. Is it a similar kind of?
I think one of the key differences between the US then and China today is in terms of people being able to pay off their mortgages in China, that's not the problem.
Right.
Whereas it obviously was a concern in the US.
Exactly.
That's not a problem in China. People have the money. They have record amount of savings.
Because the savings rate is very high in China, isn't it? That's the other difference. So
yes.
If you go to work, you save about 40 or 50% of your income. Is that right?
Yeah. So culturally, there is much more. Yeah, there's much more of a saving culture there, just generally. But since the pandemic, those savings have increased even more.
Right.
As we were talking about before, that willingness to spend just isn't there. So people are just saving their money. There have also been reports of people having their salaries cut in China, even companies asking for bonuses that they gave
asking them back.
Mm-hmm. And that's why people don't want to spend, because they're concerned that, the future, somebody asked for
And why is that? Just to ensure the jobs still stay and the business survives? Is that why the businesses are asking for it back?
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're saying, corporate debt is fairly high.
Because there has been, before this stimulus package, there were a lot of comparisons between China and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
The whole deflation argument. Obviously, it took Japan, I think it was 30 years to kind of get through it. Do you see the similarities, or do you think it's a very different system and maybe they've got more, I guess, plugs to pull, levers to pull.
It's similar, but as you said, they have more levers to pull. Mm. It's also, a closed economy is so different. And you've got that chart on the aging population.
Yeah, so this brings me neatly to the aging population situation. This is a chart from MRB Partners this time. And it shows the population of 0 to 24-year-olds out and out falling. And the proportion of 65-year-old plus is essentially double the population of the 0 to 24-year-olds.
Yeah.
So you've got a massively aging population, which has obviously been brought about by the one-child policy that's now been in place for 50 years or so, although they relaxed it last year, didn't they?
They have relaxed.
Still hasn't really changed. So, fertility rates are very low, and I forgot to put the fertility rate chart in, but it's like 1.1. So nowhere near replacement rate. So they're getting to a point where population starts shrinking from here as well as aging. Plus you've got high levels of debt, plus you've had a property boom. So to come back to your point, Husey, looks a lot like Japan.
Sounds very similar
20,
to Japan,
30 years ago,
it?
Right?
Yep.
And therefore, what are the equities worth? Is eight times earnings right for that sort of structural backdrop? Or is 10, 12 times? You've got good businesses and good companies there for sure. So,
it's certainly a challenge. And the shape of that is very similar to Japan. It is definitely a challenge. I would say, obviously, that the difference is the sheer size of China's market.
Yeah.
Obviously, I think Japan's population peaked at about 124 million, whereas China's is 1.4 billion. And you can see from that chart, you're in the hundreds of millions in terms of working age population. So that, I think that does have an impact as well. I think there's also lessons to be learned from Japan in terms of how do you tackle this? What are the things that they can do? One of the things that I think they have changed this very recently is actually the retirement age in China is relatively low. So retirement for men is 60. It's 55 for white collar women, and then 50 for working class women. So it is very low. So they have a bit of room there to move that around.
Yeah, and certainly you'd think that the policy measures, the monetary policy measures just announced, and potentially some fiscal, is very much a case of, you know, we've seen what's happened elsewhere over history. Yeah. We need to act now before this, you know, before we're in a sort of bit of a doom loop as the as they were in Japan. I guess the main difference was that in 1989 in Japan, you know, the stock market was trading on 60 times earnings, and you're in massive bubble territory, right? Whereas the Chinese stock market's definitely not in that situation.
But also in terms of with Japan, a lot of the property issues was around commercial.
Okay.
Whereas actually in China, it's residential. So there's a slight difference there as well.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. You know, they do have a lot more control from the top, don't they, to be able to
there's a lot more
move things around. And ultimately, I think it's fine. Fidelity here have provided us a chart on GDP growth. Carly, you mentioned it earlier about they've got their 5% GDP growth target.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see that over time in the last 10 years, you know, GDP growth has on average decelerated from sort of 7-8% in 2016 to, obviously the pandemic distorts the figures in the middle there, but you know, we're down at the sort of 5%, the target 5%, is that right?
Yeah,
and that, you know, again, if your population is a big driver of GDP growth in itself, but certainly the blue bits of the bars here shows the contribution of household consumption. And your point, Charlie, Carly, about consumer spending, you know, certainly there's no evidence that consumers are spending a lot more than they were. If anything, the contribution of consumer spending is falling. Now, if consumers are sat on loads of cash and property prices stop falling and a little bit of confidence returns, the spending could return, you know, pretty meaningfully, right? And we've said that about the UK, because the UK savings rate is quite high, and a little bit of confidence can actually make quite a big difference quite quickly.
I think it's slightly outdated now and it will be higher, but I think last year they were saying that since the beginning of the pandemic, household savings has gone up about $7 trillion, something crazy like that. Yeah. So if we're not saying all of that's going to come flooding back into the market, but even just a little bit of $7 trillion is a huge amount of money.
Yeah,
I mean, you've just caught up with, I think it's been, is it a Fidelity conference over the last couple of days? And you've caught up with some of the managers, and one of them is the China Consumer Fund. I mean, what was the view there from kind of China, from consumer confidence and how to get the spending back? Did I say anything on that?
Yeah, it is difficult. I think we need to see much more on the fiscal side, as we were saying before. But again, it's are these kind of one-off payments and things that are kind of it's a short, sharp kind of fix, or is it something that's actually going to be a lot more sustainable? And I guess it's the shape of the fiscal stimulus as well that'll really matter. And again, you know, it really does rest on the property market as well. Because as we were saying, a lot of that consumer confidence has been eroded because people's wealth from the property prices
just disappeared.
So, you know, if you can, it's not, I don't think it's necessarily about increasing property prices, it's just about stabilizing them. Because, you know, why would you buy a property if you think in a couple months' time it's going to be even cheaper? And it's the same with anything. You know, if they're in a deflationary environment, why would you buy something today?
Your asset's falling. If you've got a mortgage fixed against it, then your equity is shrinking. And you know, leverage works both ways, right? And it works pretty savagely in reverse. Stabilizing property prices.
Because of course, it's not. I mean, the emerging markets. You know, for our emerging market funds, obviously China is a big proportion, but you know, managers can have less exposure to China than they want, which is important. But it's not just for the EM funds. I mean, with our European luxury companies, you know, we've seen it in LVMH, Hermes, and you know, the China consumer has got softer. So it's important we see the confidence coming back. And I guess this is, you know, it's encouraging to see something being done. But, you know, as you said, we need a bit more evidence that it's actually coming through, and hopefully it does change sort of consumers' viewpoints. You do get some spending, some of that savings being spent. We've got the same problem in the, you know, in the UK in a similar way. We've got very high savings rates, and the government is struggling to encourage savers to spend.
But, I think it's quite evident that you've seen a big change in consumer habits as well, and the types of things that people are buying. So something that we heard from Fidelity is you know, pre-pandemic we were talking all about, you know, in China it was is much more about premiumization and buying the you know, the more branded things, and but actually since the pandemic you're seeing quite a bifurcation between you know, actually down trading. So for certain things you're happier to buy the cheaper version. You don't, you're not really that bothered about that, but then there's certain things where you think no I will pay up for that. So I think that's quite a change that we're seeing. So what the kind of the middle part is actually the bit that's kind of struggling more so than the lower end and the ultra high end, because actually it's the, you know, the people who would be buying the very high end things, they're not really being that impacted in the first place.
No, that's fair. And I think to your point on that, I think Nick said that one of the, there's a Japanese beauty stock that does makeup, and I can't remember the life of me remember the name.
Is it Shiseido?
Yes. And they had seen China's sales fall off a cliff because they have been borne the brunt of down trading in cosmetics. There hasn't been broad declines in cosmetic sales in China. However, it's from that middle bit down traded to local brands that are significantly cheaper.
I think that's really important as well, is there is much more of a focus on local domestic brands, homegrown things. And I think that's also because, you know, you're seeing much more of a kind of a bit of, you know, patriotism and you know, you're proud to be, you know, using your domestic brands and things like that. But also I think something that's quite interesting is obviously you have these like large international brands which see sell into China, but you know, the turnaround time with these massive corporations is actually quite long. I know some people who work for some of these large conglomerates, and they say actually if we're thinking about what we're doing for, you know, the following Christmas, we're doing it almost 12 months before. So the lead time is quite long for these massive corporations, whereas in China, you know, the trends change quite quickly. The fact that they are able to you know, really focus on their domestic market and shorten that lead time actually makes a big difference.
Interesting.
And talking of locally produced, that leads me on very neatly to electric vehicles, which has been, you know, as you mentioned before we started, China, the streets in China are very quiet because you just see electric vehicles whirring around, which I quite like that idea actually. But China had stolen a massive march on the rest of the world with electric vehicle production. We've got two charts here again from our friends at Fidelity. And the left-hand chart is EV market share, and China has 60% market share of electric vehicles. And we can see that you know, everywhere else has suffered, notably Germany, yellow. And if you go and look at the Volkswagen or BMW share prices, that's pretty evident just by looking at the chart, and they've had some pretty well known. And of course the Chinese are now trying to export plenty of their electric vehicles to the West, and we can see the right hand chart here is exports of cars, and Chinese line is the dark blue line, which is the only one that's really going up. So they've managed to build themselves a pretty phenomenal electric vehicle capacity in a very short space of time.
Yeah.
We've also seen in Europe this week, the EU have put tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, and the US have done the same.
Yeah.
So this has become a sort of big bone of contention. But it's quite impressive how they managed to build this, you know, this industry from scratch pretty much in no time at all, right?
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. And you can really see there's that, obviously, that dip in 2020 and this upward trajectory, which is pretty steep. And I think it you know, comes from a recognition that they weren't really going to get anywhere with kind of traditional OEMs. So, you know, let's focus on something that we think that we could have an edge in. It also coincides with at the end of September 2020, when President Xi came out with some pretty ambitious targets around the environment and things. So it was to have peak carbon emissions by, I think, 2030, and then be carbon neutral by 2060.
Okay.
So he said that at the end of 2020, and you can see from that chart that is really where it kind of kicks turns off. So there has been a real encouragement by the Chinese government, and you know, we want to be investing alongside the government, not against China. So they really have prioritized that in, you know, a lot of their stimulus measures around that as well. So there have been subsidies to the EV market. But you know, they really benefit from the fact that they are able to produce really high quality electric vehicles at cheaper prices. You know, part of this is because they have widespread use of low cost lithium batteries. One of the largest battery manufacturers, if not the largest in the world, I think CATL is Chinese.
Right.
So, you know, they have access to these types of things.
They've also got the rare earths that go into the batteries in the first place as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's a huge advantage. They have economies of scale. They have, you know, vertically integrated production. So, you know, all of these things have really worked in their favor. And I think of the top 10 best-selling electric vehicle manufacturers in the world, six of them are Chinese.
Is that right?
It's BYD, isn't it?
BYD has overtaken
Tesla. Mate of mine just bought BYD. It's quite smart.
I was going to say, what's the verdict?
It's quite smart. I mean, I had a look at it and I sat in it. I haven't been in it, but I was... You know,
the other ones you see a lot of are the Polestar ones.
Yeah, they're not Chinese, are they? Are they
Swedish? It's owned by... It's Volvo. It's linked to Volvo, yeah, which is owned by a Chinese parent. Yeah.
Certainly,
yeah. BYD is the main one, but yeah, there's a load of
them.
Li Auto, XPeng. What's the other one as well? Geely.
But the politics are quite fascinating here, aren't they? Yeah. Because particularly in Germany, is hugely reliant on the car industry, but all of Europe really, VW, BMW, etc.
Yeah, exactly.
They've got plants all over you, but even the UK, we still make quite a lot of cars in the UK. So if all of a sudden our market, because I think, pretty sure I got this right, the US have put 100% tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles into the US, so that effectively prices them out of the market. So the fear was that all of that production would be diverted to Europe and they would flood the market with £20,000-£25,000 electric vehicles versus a VW at 40 or 50. So that's why the EU, I think last week, did vote for tariffs on Chinese EVs. And of course, you've now got tit for tat. What was the story of the week about cognac? So the Chinese anti-dumping measures on top cognac, so you know, not ideal for Pernod Ricard or Diageo. But and then of course you've got the US election, which is a bit elephant in the room, really, isn't it? Because Mr. Trump, if he gets elected, is, you know, pretty hawkish on China and tariffs, and tariffs are his new best friend. So we'll have to kind of see how that goes. So again, you know, this is another sort of reason. If you take the debt, the falling house prices, the potential for tariffs, there was a reason why Chinese equities are trading cheap, right? But we've, all of a sudden, things can change quite quickly when a government realises that there's a problem and that they need to do things. And I think, you know, certainly the rally in the last 2 weeks has shown us what can happen when things change. And as our old colleague Dave used to say, you know, good things happen to cheap assets, right? So they were cheap assets, and we'll see how it goes in terms of the fiscal. Anything else, Carly, that you wanted to sort of leave our viewers and listeners with in terms of messages?
No, I don't think so.
Are you a bull in a China shop? Yeah.
I'm certainly more positive on Chinese equities than I was a few months ago. You know, as you said, I think it's this very clear, you know, orchestrated, you know, stimulus measures. I think the fact that they are doing this, it just shows that they are serious about it. They care about the stock market. They don't want to see it just falling continuously.
Because I didn't mention that at the start today, they've also pulled together a stabilisation fund, which they're going to use to buy equities or lend money to borrow money to buy equities, which again is direct intervention in the stock market. Yeah. So the government's on your side now, right?
Yes, and they're trying, and with that as well, they're trying to encourage people to put their money into the stock market as well. So again, we're saying there's $7 trillion in savings or whatever it is now, even just, you know, a few percent of that into the stock market.
Yeah, it's huge.
And that's something that a number of fund managers that I've spoken to are looking at as well, in terms of, you know, retail account openings and things like that, through the, which they can get through brokerages.
Yeah, maybe there needs some sort of ISA, some sort of Chinese ISA.
Chaser.
We've canned the British ISA, haven't we? So,
I know. That got cancelled before it even started. It did.
Yeah.
Which
is
a shame.
Well, Colin, it's been an absolute treat. Thank you for your time this morning. And we hope you enjoyed that and found that interesting. Any questions, then let us know. He's james.hughes@courtachievia.com. I'm jonathan.raymond@courtachievia.com. And we will see you soon. Thanks very much. Bye bye.